Welcome, welcome to the Katie Speaks Show, streaming here on Netroots Radio every Saturday and Monday. You can get the podcast for free via iTunes and Stitcher, and subscribe at patreon.com/Katie_speak to support the show and get bonus content as well as an early listen to the show. I'm your host, Katie Klubusik. Find me on Twitter and Medium at Katie_speak. Info for guests and links to topics can be found in the episode notes at katiespeak.com, along with other ways to support this show as well as my other work. All right, everybody, we made it through another week, which is not saying nothing these days. So I know that I promised that while I was on this cross-country stuff collection tour with my brother that I would be playing pre-produced shows for you, new but pre-produced, so that I didn't have to try and record in a U-Haul with that really unfortunate airplane-like sound in the background that would have sent all of you running, or at least ripping your earbuds out of your ears. However, my friend Aaron Kappel, who's been on the show before, finally published a set of pieces that they've been working on for the better part of a year. And I was so excited because I've heard about them that I wanted to interview Aaron right away to talk about it. Really, really, really important stuff that isn't getting... that just doesn't get reported on, and that's some things that go on in some of our scare quotes around Christian boarding and reform schools. It's really terrifying. Aaron focuses on the Shepherd's Hill Academy in Georgia, but please know while you're listening that these abuses happen We're not sure how many places or how often, and how do they stay open? Spoiler: money. So definitely a sizable content note for today's episode: child abuse, anti-LGBTQ reparative therapy, all kinds of things. Pretty much, if it's a trigger topic, then please take care with this episode. Because of that, I'm going to play my interview with Kit O'Connell first. That way you don't have to tune out and come back if the chat with Aaron isn't something that you can listen to safely. So Kit's on to talk about something that I actually don't know very much about, which I like doing, and I hope that you'd like listening to. I very often learn right alongside you. It's part of why I love doing the show. It's my excuse to learn and to broaden out of the topics that I spend a lot of time writing about. So Kit is on to talk about sort of personal security, and there's some new revelations for WikiLeaks. Kit gives the official disclaimer, yes, WikiLeaks is problematic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we go ahead and focus on the documents that got released recently and what they might mean. Also, it looks like the legislature and the administration is seen fit to mine even more of our metadata. Kit does a really great explanation of what metadata is, and we talk about ways to protect yourself. And, you know, they're not conspiracy theory ways. These are important. Where to talk about, where not to talk about, actions that you're planning, different ways you can be recorded without really realizing it. And then we do some sort of LOL sob moments about Amazon's Alexa, because it turns out that data has been turned over in prosecutions. Like, we just... nothing has been thwarted by the use of metadata, so why not collect more of it and pay a ton of money to store it, right? Best use of our tax dollars ever. So that's the show today. I am actually recording this introduction from Utah. We've made it almost all the way across the country. Started in... Brooklyn, where a good friend was kind enough to put us up and picked up the last of the stuff that I sort of had to abandon, I had to abandon on the East Coast when I was forced to move to the West Coast. And feels good to have that stuff back, let me tell you. And then we stopped in Chicago to pick up my brother's stuff, and we stopped and saw the folks that I lovingly call my spare parents, because I write a lot about my childhood being disowned and the traumas therein. I actually have a piece coming out at Catapult that talks about my dad a lot and my fear of failure, and that's been super fun to edit, which is why it's not out yet. It's in the very capable hands of the amazing Nicole Callahan, who many of you probably know from The Toast. She's landed at Catapult, which is a great website. If you haven't checked it out, please check it out. Really great personal narratives there. So I lovingly call my brother's parents my spare parents. For those of you who haven't heard me talk about him before, we became really good friends in college, so 20 years ago, and we're both adopted only children, so family has zip to do with blood. And, you know, eventually at some point you'd spend time in hospitals and at holidays and going through stuff together. And it just seems silly to introduce someone as your friend, so-and-so. And his parents have seen me as their kid pretty much right away. And it was really lovely to spend some time with them and reaffirm that familial tie. You know, I have gotten along fine without parents, but it's nice not to have to. And they're really great people, and I felt really good to see them in person and really get to thank them for everything they've done for me and for us, and to let them know how great it is going to be to visit us in San Diego instead of Chicago, because we have palm trees. And so we've made it to Utah today, and then we're heading the rest of the way to California. I'm sitting in one of my favorite people's living rooms, the amazing Dr. Leah Torres. I've had her on the show. You all probably follow her on Twitter. This is definitely a trip brought to you by abortion. And it's been really great to have this excuse to reconnect with people and be reminded of the in-person generosity, really, that is pretty overwhelming in my life. So because of all that, I was able to do some new interviews, and I hope that you enjoy them. And again, please take care with the content note. And so up first will be Kit, and then there will be a decent, sizable musical interlude before we get to the interview with Erin.
You're mine, you belong to me, and I'm not afraid to let people see.
Joining me is my friend Kit O'Connell. He's a gonzo journalist and radical troublemaker for hire, so hire him, whose writing appears at his site, kitoconnell.com, The Establishment, The Texas Observer, and Truthout, among other publications. Follow him at Kit O'Connell. He's proudly disabled, polyamorous, and queer, and he shares a house with a friend, a cat, a vegetable garden, and a big kitchen in Austin, which is where he joins me now. Kit, thank you so much for taking time to come on, last minute even.
Hi, Kate. It's great to be here. I love the show, and so it's exciting to get a chance to talk.
Thank you. I want to start with your piece, How to Survive Hurricane Donald, because so many of my listeners, and me for sure, are really just trying to figure out how they're going to make it through the next 4 years without either freaking out or, you know, completely, or hitting a wall and becoming, you know, apathetic as a survival tactic. And you wrote, "These are terrifying times, and the idea of responding to so many disasters at once feels impossible. To me, the only hope lies in hyper-local organizing and then building coalitions from there." So tell us what that kind of organizing looks like.
Yeah, and, you know, I was inspired in this piece, though it doesn't actually mention him in this one. I was inspired especially kind of in the back of my head by an organizer named Liam Shea, who actually died about basically the same day I published that piece, unexpectedly. And he was a major organizer with Occupy Sandy. And we met through the Occupy movement and had just a lot of good conversations about that. And he really inspired me. There was something he said to me. I was interviewing him about his organizing during Occupy Sandy, which, of course, for people who don't know, after Hurricane Sandy, a lot of Occupy movements kind of took the lead in their local neighborhoods in organizing survival and recovery efforts. You know, the Red Cross does some good work, but they kind of come into a disaster area like that, serve hot dogs for about a week, and then kind of take off. And so these people were doing some real incredible organizing to rebuild, to share supplies, and even teach people to advocate for themselves. And, you know, at the end of our conversation I had with Liam in 2014, when I was interviewing him about this effort a couple years, you know, after the hurricane, I asked him, you know, are you going to have to move? He lived in Staten Island in a neighborhood that, you know, had been severely flooded, and we're predicting more and more floods as climate change gets worse. And so I said to him, do you think you and people like you are going to have to abandon that neighborhood? And his answer was so strongly no. You know, it was like, I'm going to stay here and fight. You know, I'm not going to let them gentrify us with water, was the phrase that he used. And that was really in the back of my head when I was writing that piece, because you know, we are looking at actual disasters. You know, Hurricane Donald, to some extent, is an actual natural disaster, mm-hmm. because they're just going to take all the stops off of fossil fuels. But then we also have all these other issues coming up, too. You know, immigration, they're trying to roll back all kinds of LGBTQIA rights. You know, even like food for kids in school and for elderly people. It's just ridiculous the amount of things that they're going after. And so, yeah, it does feel overwhelming. And that includes me. I feel overwhelmed all the time. But to me, I think we have to look at the people around us, and we have to build solutions in our neighborhoods and in our communities. You know, when I say hyperlocal, I want us to look at, you know, literally the people next door to us. But also, I think a lot of us have these kinds of local communities that aren't necessarily like exactly neighborhoods, but it might be like all your queer friends, or even just all your friends that get together and play board games.
Right.
And I want us to really look at those networks and build them out, expand them, reach out to those neighbors, and then figure out ways we can, you know, I'm going to say politicize those networks or even radicalize those networks. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to invite your neighbors to, you know, go blockade a pipeline, although you certainly could. But I think in a more immediate needs that we're all looking at now, you know, it starts by just having these sorts of conversations where we turn to our neighbors and say, what do you need? What are you afraid of right now? How can we support you?
That's really huge. You know, it's in my San Diego is definitely the place that I've lived where I feel like I have the most community, and my communities all overlap, but I definitely have the most of it there. I have, you know, most of my family by choice is there. In fact, the road trip I'm on right now is to move my brother there. So, aside from my spare parents, which, I call them that to differentiate them from my adoptive parents, who are not so great because I write about them a lot. But aside from them, everyone will be there pretty much. And we really feel, especially, you know, since November, even more so, like we're all in it together. I mean, I'm calling this, you know, cross country with the U-Haul trip, you know, sort of a resource collection. We got the last of my stuff in Jersey. We're picking up my brother's in Chicago, his car in Iowa, and like all of us making sure that material needs, not in the capitalistic way, but just like your material daily needs are met. And we very much feel like we're in it together in a way that I definitely think has developed since the election.
Yeah, you know, I'm seeing that here in Austin as well. You know, a lot of us are building just these really close networks. Some of us have been doing activism or work together, community work together for a long time, but we're kind of drawing into these stronger affinity groups, which is a great term. People should look up what an affinity group is and start forming them. You know, part of doing that is starting the conversations now and getting together now. It might just be like going out for a hike with some of those people that you might want to be doing volunteer work with, but just sort of building the social connections and the emotional connections between the people like you're talking about, your family of choice and your close network.
Yeah, there's definitely ways to get involved locally, and that's something that I, you know, encourage people who are new to activism or volunteer work, things like that, to do. That there really is something about, you know, even just like a volunteer shift at your food bank or talking to your neighbors and planning if you're in a space, if you live in an area with enough like actual green space, or creating green space so that you can all grow food, right? Like that's why I jokingly included your vegetable garden. But you know, we're growing some stuff at my house, and you know, my best friend here is, has basically turned her entire backyard into a community garden, right? And is sharing that stuff to make sure that we all have what we need just in a very, you know, basic way. Like you said, you know, getting active in your community doesn't have to mean chaining yourself to a pipeline. You know, I'm not going to tell people not to do that. But don't get intimidated, you know, by, you know, starting out thinking that you're going to be like required to do something that will get you arrested.
Sure. And I'd also like, you know, I want to emphasize, it's not even just that you don't have to do it, but that these small things are so vital. You know, I was obviously so inspired here in Austin. Our women's march was just massive. Like they had this circular route from the Capitol back, And they couldn't even finish at one end before people were getting back to the Capitol because there were just so many tens of thousands of people. And that's beautiful. It was gorgeous, just an incredible day. But we can't just have those days. We're going to be exhausted. We're already getting exhausted. Yes. But, you know, that these meetings, book groups, discussions, community gardens, getting together and writing letters to political prisoners, all these things are building connections that are so important and I think are just going to be increasingly vital as we move into these next four years. Yeah, it looks so scary.
Me too. And they also, those, you know, smaller, and I don't mean less important, just literally numbers wise, smaller, you know, organizing groups and friendship and community groups really provide the base for when you need to do something like a women's march. You know, if you're already connected in those ways, then when something like that is happening, then you have more people to bring.
Exactly. You have all these new networks that you can reach out to. And, you know, I know one of my closest comrades here in Austin, she's just recently, you know, started organizing a lot of sort of the moms in her neighborhood.
Love it.
And she's, you know, some of them, you know, they're just getting started. And so some of the stuff they want to do is stuff that might feel frustrating to more experienced activists, like petitions and stuff. But, you know, they're also at the same time, they have this like this radical anger, I'm going to call it, for lack of a better word, that's so needed right now. And these are just, you know, regular people, you know, that not necessarily think of themselves as activists, but they really want to do something. They want tangible things that they can do. And I think all of us do. And if we kind of work together, we can all find tangible things that we can do.
Angry moms get stuff done. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
I'm here for it. Do you have any new or more emphasized self-care practices these days that you're doing to kind of get through and survive the frustration and the exhaustion?
You know, I'm not perfect about this, but
none of us are.
but Andrea Grimes suggested has been talking on her Twitter about how she does a sort of blackout period of her phone, not just 30 minutes before bed, but also 30 minutes after she gets up. Mm-hmm. And I know for me, and I'm not doing it every day, but I know I feel better on the days where I do it. And especially I've been trying to do it on, you know, I tweeted something controversial before I went to bed. And so I can probably guess that when I pop up in the morning, my Twitter is going to have a few, you know, angry eggs, or maybe I'll call them anime Nazis. We all know who these people are. You know, and so it sort of helps me to create this window to ensure that the first thing I see in the morning is not somebody saying, you know, F you effing F, you know, I mean, just, you know, whatever they want to say to me, you know, whatever weird words they've come up to call me. It's not the first thing I see in the morning, you know, and I mean, I'm going to be the first to admit I'm a screen addict. And so sometimes that first 30 minutes in the morning is reading on my Kindle.
But that's not engaging, like, right? And it's
exactly,
it's also chilling out. Like, as an introvert, I have to remind myself that, you know, in contrary to a think piece, scare quotes around think, that got published recently, you know, interpersonal interactions can happen without other people in the room, right? So Twitter and email and like having to engage with editors for edits and like interviewing people, all that stuff that you and I do as part of our work is pretty interaction intense. And so for me, I, you know, I'm usually perpetually reviewing something. So my time in the middle of the day, not just at the end when I've run out of steam and can't work anymore, I make sure I go sit outside on the patio. Like, I change a location. That's an area that feels like it should be more screen free for me, even if screen free, like you, is sort of a loose thing, because I'm out there, you know, reading on a Kindle, but I'm not engaging. And that has definitely been helpful. And it was hard to do initially because you have to like stop an impulse, but it's definitely helped.
And I mean, you mentioned, we've talked about it already, but boy, gardening is such a great, it's, for me, it's such a great self-care thing. And, you know, especially when I'm dealing with something, you know, that's the story in the news or the story that I'm working on is getting to me. I really, it helps to just go pull some weeds or stick my hands in the dirt in some other fashion.
Yes, because you can pound on the ground there and not have a diverse reactions around you. So we have to do some security talk, and this is an area I admittedly know very little about. So feel free to fill in things or correct my awkward questions. You wrote a piece titled What Vault 7 Means for You and How to Protect Yourself with Encryption. So let's start at the beginning. What is Vault 7?
Sure. So Vault 7 is the biggest recent leak from WikiLeaks. And, you know, like so many of us, I have mixed feelings about WikiLeaks. It probably was beyond the scope of this conversation. But I tend to think that the documents they release on their website are generally real documents.
Yes.
That's something that there has not been a lot to say otherwise. And so Vault 7 is essentially the cyber weapons vault of the CIA. And according to the unknown source that WikiLeaks says leaked this information, these tools essentially got out of control of the CIA for some amount of time and were being traded freely among government contractors. And so we, of course, have this. Yeah, exactly.
What could go wrong?
Situation.
It's not like we've seen that go wrong before. Mm.
Exactly. And it is very similar to Snowden, in that Snowden was this government contractor, not an actual government employee, but someone who worked for one of the many humongous corporations that our government outsources a lot of war and spying to these days. And so similarly, these tools have been given to contractors, but even after they're done with their CIA contracts, they have these tools and they're sharing them around.
Is this like when I worked for a magazine when I was in college, back before online publishing, because I'm old, and I needed to have like Quark or something installed on my computer in order to work at home. So like the stuff is loaded on my computer, and then after I quit, like it's still there, so I still have it. Is it analogous to that? Probably, as far as
we know, it is. But also, like, maybe then your friend said, hey, you've got Quark. Yeah. Can you copy it over to me? And then you did, which obviously is difficult with these apps like Quark. But, you know, instead, you know, this is something that could be transferred. And so, yeah, it is very similar to that from what we know. And these are very scary tools, especially if it's the first you're hearing about the capability to do these kinds of things. It lets them, you know, spy on people through their Samsung smart TVs. Those can be used as microphones and...
I have one of those.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a little disturbing, isn't it? Yeah. So, you know, in addition to that, you know, they've been able to get malware on a lot of Windows computers. And I forget whether Mac was involved in the malware attacks, but certainly Android and iPhone are both have been compromised, at least theoretically, by the CIA using these tools. And what that means is that they, again, theoretically, can just actually listen to our phones, listen to our conversations, or turn the phones on as microphones.
So should we say hi to the CIA right now? Because I'm recording this on Skype.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and Skype is another perfect one. We should say hi to the CIA. Vault 7 revealed that they're able to kind of automatically convert Skype conversations into text and then store it in the cloud for them to search later.
I love that you immediately did manage to go silver lining in the piece. You wrote, you may have heard the CIA could be listening to your phone conversations, recording your Skype calls, spying on you through your TV. The leak is terrifying to be sure, but it also gives tech companies valuable new information about how to protect their users. So what are you hoping might come out of these revelations?
Sure. Yeah. And I'm certainly hoping it's kind of two-pronged. One is that, you know, activists have another. This isn't the first time that we've known that people are being spied on, or that there's some scary tools out there. But any excuse to encourage people to take some steps to protect themselves is good. But from a corporate standpoint, I'm hoping that, you know, Samsung, Apple, Google, Skype, possibly if they can, all these companies will be doing something to lock down, to get the WikiLeaks has promised to share more of the data of these security holes. What they've published to their website and to the media does not allow you to exploit those tools. They didn't actually publish those tools to everyone. So it's not like I can go on WikiLeaks website and now I can listen to your Samsung TV.
Oh, God, I didn't think about that. That's good.
Right? Isn't that? Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't mean that those tools aren't out there in some hackers' hands, but WikiLeaks is not enabling that. What WikiLeaks has said they're going to do, and I don't know the details of this project, but they've said that they're going to share that info with Samsung and with these companies so that they can patch the security vulnerabilities. And to add to the silver lining, one of the things we're seeing is that more and more people are taking steps to protect themselves and to hide their conversations, to encrypt their conversations. And so it's actually forcing the CIA to use these messier tools to get through to the people that they want to target. And it's become harder for them to just do a sweep of everyone's conversations because fewer people, you know, yeah, we're still using Skype for this conversation, but like, I'm not going to use Skype to plan an activist event.
Right.
You know, I'm going to use other tools. And so that makes it all harder. Everybody who's, you know, people locking down makes it harder for the CIA. And so while this is all scary, it's also a sign that some of the precautions we're taking are working, that we're making the surveillance state work harder and spend more money and more time and more people power to spy on us. And that is good.
Yeah, this is a really important issue as, you know, the resistance pockets we were talking about earlier, you know, are popping up. And new activists who may not have had to consider these things before, you know, are joining the fight. So what are things that people, you know, a couple of things that people as individuals can do to protect themselves and each other?
Yeah. You know, I want to take a moment to talk briefly about this concept called threat modeling, which is a concept that comes out of the military, out of like computer security. And so it's a very, it's a militaristic concept, but it is useful for us to think about it just because it's how the government also thinks. But threat modeling is basically whenever you're looking at something that you're doing, whether you want to protect your little network of activists that you're building in your neighborhood or something that you're planning to do, anything really where you have information, whether that's plans or actual data to protect. And there's a great website that the EFF has called Surveillance Self-Defense.
Yes,
and
it's great.
SSDF, which is Surveillance Self-Defense, ssdf.eff.org. And so they've got a threat modeling set there of five questions. But the three questions that you really need to know to remember is anytime you're trying, I need to keep things safe. I'm worried about surveillance or I'm worried about police interference or corporate interference or hackers or just about anything. You know, far right trolls, we need to protect ourselves from them too these days. So ask yourself the questions. The key questions are, you know, what do I want to protect? Who do I want to protect it from? And what are the consequences if I fail? So, you know, the example that I used in my piece were two different direct actions, one of which was a banner drop. You know, three activists have a message that they want to broadcast. So they agree to paint a banner, go to an overpass, tie it to the overpass, and then leave. Right? Now, that is technically illegal, probably. You're littering or something like that. But, you know, the police are not going to expend much effort to shut it down, even probably if they heard about it ahead of time.
Right.
And if you did fail, probably the worst that happened is there'd be a cop waiting there and he'd say, hey, kids, move on. Don't do this.
Right.
You know, or maybe you'd get fined or something is a very worst case scenario. You'd get a ticket. So, you know, that's like pretty low risk. And so, you know, I still wouldn't plan it on Skype, but I'm not going to worry that much about it. If we get together at a coffee shop to talk about it, or even, you know, we're in my living room, but we've got, you know, our smart TV nearby. I know that the CIA, yes, they can turn on my smart TV, but the regular cops can't. And either way, they don't really care.
Right.
Right. Now, if I'm planning a multi-day protest or to shut down a highway or we're going to occupy the Texas legislature, which I would love to see happen, not that I'm planning anything like that, but then I would take a lot more precaution because I know there's going to be more people involved. There's going to be more people trying to shut us down. And the risks that we're taking, the legal risks and the physical risks that we're taking are much higher. And so, you know, there's some things I wouldn't plan on Facebook there. And there's times where even like if we were getting together for a very sensitive action, we would probably even leave our phones at home before doing that.
Right.
Just on the off chance that someone wanted to listen to us so badly that they were going to use our phone as a listening device.
The thing that really got me was, I love I love your depiction of it. There's no doubt that the surveillance state has upped their spy game. What used to take a team of people to bug your room and then lurk in a creepy van down the street now takes one guy in his office watching you watch your TV. Essentially, we've willingly let the cops and the feds into our living rooms. Amazon even turned over Alexa recordings to police in an Arkansas murder case in early March. Come on, Alexa?
Yeah. And I don't even know the details of the case exactly, but yeah, they had some conversation. I don't know, maybe, you know, I can imagine sort of the Dexter version of this, which is like, you know, Alexa, order me gloves and plastic sheeting, right?
Right? Alexa, where's the cheapest place to get an axe? I don't know. Like,
I don't know what they were looking up. You know, Alexa, tell me about undetectable poison.
Alexa, reorder duct tape.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very strange situation, but it does, you know, one of the things that, you know, there's this concept of metadata, which helps, you know, it's not the actual data. Like, our conversation right now is data. Somebody recorded it. They're just recording our conversation. But metadata is that somewhere there's a record that you made a Skype call to me.
Right.
And theoretically, the NSA or the spy agencies or the police could subpoena the records of everyone you talk to. And our shopping habits definitely add to that. You know, we're constantly sharing what we do, what we look at, what we shop for. And of course, there's that new bill that the House just passed, right, that would sell our broadband browsing activity. It would let broadband providers sell our activity.
Oh, man. For those of us who do writing and research, that would be hilarious. I am just picturing the conclusions that might be drawn from reading my browser history.
I know. Same here. I know. I mean, so... yeah, there's a lot of things that we take for granted that we're putting out in the world. And we, you know, part of threat modeling is also starting to think about whether that stuff puts you at risk or, you know, whether it puts your comrades at risk. You know, even if you personally have nothing to hide, if you know people that are activists, it's a good idea for you to take some extra steps to protect yourself.
Yes, and maybe,
so let's get into some of the steps, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I like it. You know, and it goes back full circle to asking people what they need. You know, if you're participating in those things, make sure that the people that you're organizing with have what they need from you, you know, both as support and also, you know, to make sure that nobody is being endangered in multiple ways, right? If there are people that can't risk arrest, if there are, you know, people with disabilities where, you know, there's participation limitations, you know, and things like that, we have to make sure that the people that we're, you know, in community with, that we're caring for on multiple levels. And I really, really appreciate you being willing to do this work and to talk about it. So everyone has to go follow Kit at Kit O'Connell on Twitter, read his words, and get bonus content through his Patreon, patreon.com/Kit O'Connell. Kit, thank you so much for being on and for the work you do every day.
Thank you.
A writer, artist, and fundamentalist Christian school survivor. Their Sharkies and Black Hat are reason enough to follow them on Twitter and Instagram at Aaron Kappel. You can read their words at The Establishment, Rewire, and anywhere else lucky enough to have them. Aaron, thank you so much for coming back on.
Thanks for having me back.
Before we dive in, I just want to tell you how lovely it is being able to call you a real friend now that we've met in person and shared a meal.
You're like physically touched, so it's not a mirage.
You're a real human being, I know for sure.
Yes, I am not a bot.
Or a figment of my imagination and my listeners' and readers' imaginations. I don't even know. This woman wrote a pretty profoundly awful piece. And so before we dive into yours, tell people why you found it a little repulsive.
Well, she basically said that friends that meet on the internet, their friendships aren't as strong and their connections aren't as real because they haven't met face to face.
Right. It's because she doesn't have the Skype or the FaceTime, or
I don't know.
Like, you and I usually do this face-to-face, but for whatever bizarre reason, my camera isn't working today, so we're not. But it's like we have basically been in the same space before. It was just, it was so ableist. Like, just the idea that, you know, you and I both deal with some anxiety issues, but for people, you know, with physical disabilities, they can't leave the house and whatever, the idea that those folks don't have friends.
Or their friends are on a lower level of other people with friends.
Yeah, yes, they're not as important or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just really awful. So pro tip: don't do that, and then also don't then follow that up by writing a piece on how social media works. Because if you don't think that you can make friends through social networking, that's why we call them networking. then possibly you shouldn't be writing about it.
Yes.
Someday I will have you on for something joyous, I promise. Today,
one day,
we'll imagine it. Today, however, we're doing a really important chat on a pair of investigative articles you really worked on for the better part of the last year. And I want to make a note for listeners that this facility we're discussing is far from the only one of its kind. So people should keep in mind that it's not an anomaly, that this isn't just, you know, you found the one really crappy place and wrote about it. This is a thing that people should be paying attention to. So tell folks what put Shepherd's Hill Academy on your radar and what it is they claim to do there.
So growing up, I went to private Christian schools that were part of the American Association of Christian Schools. And a few years ago, I decided to look into other schools in that network. And I came across Shepherd's Hill Academy, which is marketed as a therapeutic Christian boarding school with a wilderness feature, where kids grade 7 through 12 live there year round. And it's for so-called troubled teens. So kids that are struggling with mental health issues or rebellion and their parents just don't know what to do with them. This is the place that they send them to.
Yeah, for $88,900 a year and a willingness to sign power of attorney over to executive director Trace Embry, parents can get help with their kids. This was the part, like, and it's right at the beginning, y'all. You wrote, the SHA is intended for teens who are troubled. The word the Academy uses to describe those with everyone ready to, like, raise their hand if this, you know, might be them. ADD, ADHD, oppositional defiant disorder, reactive attachment disorder, PTSD, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorders, Asperger's syndrome, like that's something that needs, anyway, anger management, and generally rebellious behavior. Later you say that also includes opposition to the belief system of the family, not wanting to participate in family activities, defending peers, and general disobedience. I mean, that seems a little
being
broad.
Being a teenager. Yes.
What is it he thinks all those things have in common? Like, why do we need to be fixing teenagers in the first place?
Because they don't know Jesus. That's okay. So he takes aspects of science that is real and then adds his little twist to it. So his big thing is a thing called anhedonia, which is a common symptom in depression. It's a symptom for people struggling with addiction and even schizophrenia. And basically, it's just the inability to feel pleasure. And so Trace thinks that most, if not all, the kids that are sent to him, no matter what they are diagnosed with, they're really struggling with anhedonia. And that anhedonia is its own condition, not a symptom.
Right, even though it's a symptom, not a thing. It's one of those, like, I describe it, because I've struggled with it here and there as a symptom of my depression, and as a kid who grew up with childhood trauma, I have a tendency to think my feelings. So, like, I can tell you straight-faced that I know intellectually that I love you, but it doesn't sound that way, right? Like, my affect when I say it isn't necessarily right, because I can't really, I still have trouble feeling my feelings. And that's, you know, also I would assume that probably that's something a lot of teenagers deal with.
Right.
But he thinks it's its own thing.
He thinks it's its own thing. And he thinks this is a thing that is stopping teenagers from understanding the Christian God and biblical principles.
Right.
So I have a quote in the piece where he says that we at Shepherd's Hill understand that if the anhedonic troubled teen cannot think critically, constructively, or creatively, God becomes an abstract, too difficult and boring for the brain to conceive or desire.
Hmm. So he's hoping to make God more interesting and accessible, I guess. I mean, it just seems... It seems like if you're trying to build connection with people, then like throwing them into cabins with no way to connect to other people might not be the best plan.
Right. They're intentionally isolated from society. So like no matter why you're sent to the farm, for at least the first 10 months, you live in cabins in the middle of the woods that you help build yourself with no electricity, no running water, no access to technology whatsoever, unless it's during school hours in the classroom and a teacher is monitoring it.
Yeah.
He believes that technology, from smartphones to Beyonce.
Well, Beyonce is technology. Outstanding.
Yeah. So, I mean, like he mixes up technology and media and entertainment. He puts it all under the same umbrella. He thinks these are the things that are causing anhedonia in teenagers. And because anhedonia to him stops teenagers from understanding, believing God, and becoming Christian, converting, it is the devil, the literal devil, using technology to stop kids from becoming Christians. So it's not, this isn't a therapeutic school. It's all a ruse to indoctrinate children and convert them.
Right. And he admits that, right?
He admits this over and over and over again.
Like, I think that doesn't he use the word brainwash without really any, like, yeah, what's the problem?
Yeah, he says we're brainwashing students in the blood of the Lamb.
You know, I was religious in high school, and I managed to sort of accidentally, but luckily find a really great, actually it was a missionary church. And, you know, they really focused on the youth. And I, you know, I've said since then that, I mean, I guess probably we were pro-life and stuff, but we just didn't really spend any time in the Old Testament unless it was to use an Old Testament verse, you know, in relation to the New Testament, where it's, you're proving that God keeps his word, right? Which is really the reason mm-hmm. the Old Testament's still attached. And so, like, I can't, you know, we use that language, you know, like we've definitely had praise songs that included, you know, being washed in the blood of the Lamb, but it was all about like personal forgiveness and love. And like, I just, right. the way that he twists not just technology, but also the biblical teachings is pretty horrifying.
Yeah, he weaponizes it.
Yeah. And that's one of those things that can, you know, if you're sent there, let's say you are a teenager, you know, who believes in God, right? But you have uh-huh. some other problem that your parents are, you know, sending you there for, the kind of internal conflict that you can create by the kind of weaponizing and, you know, incorrect, all of that he's doing can really, really, well, fuck somebody up.
It really can. And like, he has a weekly podcast called License to Parent. And I bring it up a lot in the piece because they often say on the program that everything that they say on the show, all the guests that they have on, the things that they discuss are the same things that they practice at the farm. So if you listen to the podcast and think, well, this is a little bizarre, this is what they're doing at the school. For instance, recently he had a pastor and counselor on named Daniel Berger, who believes that most mental illnesses aren't legit because they aren't in the Bible.
Oh, so if it's not mentioned in the Bible and it's not real, does that mean I shouldn't have to be fighting over abortion access? Because that's not mentioned in the Bible.
You're not allowed to twist it that way. Only they are allowed to twist
it. Yes.
You know how it works, Kate.
I do know how it works. That was one of the most disturbing parts for me, as you and I talk a lot about that, and access you know, accurate and helpful mental health care is something I stumbled into in San Diego and I'm super glad for. You know, the idea that, you know, he says that the anhedonia, by the way, thanks for pronouncing that before I had to, that, you know, being overly dependent on modern technology and the medication they're prescribed, he says that's making it worse.
Yes, which is not true at all.
No, my favorite transition sentence of your piece is right after that. You were like, unsurprisingly, the science doesn't support Embry or Dr. Hart. what does the science and the Alliance for Safe Therapeutic and Appropriate Use of Residential Treatment say about their feelings and their methods?
I will quote...
I love how long this piece is, and I had to do the same thing. So I was like, wait, I have it. I know where it is.
I have it somewhere. Papers all around me.
the papers printed out and the multiple. Because I'm recording on the road on our resource collection tour, usually I have a monitor also. And so I am able to have more information in front of my eyes while I'm doing it. And now I'm forced to scroll.
Don't tell Trace. For instance, Dr. Ronald Pies, professor of psychiatry at SUNY Upstate Medical University, said, we know that serious psychiatric illnesses such as bipolar disorder and schizophrenia have existed for hundreds, if not thousands of years, long before technology came about.
Yeah, it turns out bipolar disorder predates Twitter. I mean, it sounds so ludicrous on its face. And, you know, we both have the, I have to laugh at it so I don't cry constantly reaction to most things. You know, but we could go on for an hour just about the abuses. So give us some of what you uncovered in the abuse category.
So since I wasn't able to talk to the anonymous survivor personally, I picked certain things out of his testimony that is linked in the piece that Trace openly talks about all the time and condones, like corporal punishment, which is technically legal in Georgia. It's legal in most states in the country. I think there's only 4 that ban it in schools. It's not officially banned yet.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it is a violation of the rules for obtaining the license that the state of Georgia has given Shepherd's Hill Academy.
Right, their license continues to blow my mind.
It blows my mind because they operate it illegally for 10 years.
Right, and the best part about that, tell people what they're using, how they're using that 10 years of experience.
So I'll preface this by saying that Trace does not have a college degree. Per the rules to obtain a license, you have to have all these professional training and degrees to be able to treat kids at a therapeutic boarding school. Trace does not have them. So they submitted a waiver and the waiver was approved. And the evidence that they used was Trace's 10 years of treating kids illegally on the farm.
Right. If you have a certain amount of experience, you can get a waiver for not having the right college degree. And they're like, oh yeah, he has lots of experience, 10 years. Yeah. Yeah. With the unlicensed facility. Like this is something that I'm sure like my sex worker friends wish that like they could find a way to manipulate, right? Like all of the skills that they've developed doing, you know, entrepreneurial skills and being good with people and, you know, all the emotional caretaking, they'd love to list on their resume. You know what I mean? But like they can't, you know, like.
It doesn't work that way. It's not supposed to.
No, it only works that way really for the white, self-professed Christian dudes, it turns out.
Yeah, of course.
How do they stay open? Because they must get, tell me the state of Georgia does some sort of something.
They do an annual survey every year. An on-site evaluation, and then they go through all the paperwork and the files. But for every year that they've been licensed, for every year that they've had a survey, they have failed at least two or three. They've had at least two or three violations. There hasn't been one year where they haven't passed inspection.
So how are they open?
Because it's up to the discretion of the residential child licensing unit. They must give the facility an opportunity to fix the mistakes. And once they fix the mistakes, they can either approve them or not. And if they don't approve them, technically they're supposed to enforce penalties like fines or up to as extreme as closing the facility. But they are allowed to give them another opportunity. So it's just this cycle.
So basically they're good at paperwork.
Yes, very good at paperwork.
Okay, well, let this be a lesson. We all have to get better at paperwork. You know, it's just, you know, the stuff that you outline in this piece and the one after it, you know, that this is, you know, they're performing reparative therapy and they're punishing people via isolation and these really awful sounding special meals.
Oh, yeah. So one of the punishments that they have is to not let the kids eat what everyone else is eating at mealtime. And so they just give them a can of beans and or a can of vegetables, a piece of bread and some fruits. And they're supposed to eat that at every meal until Trace or the staff deems that they were punished long enough.
That is...
Using food as punishment is just...
Yeah, it's really... If nothing else, it just feels very, I don't know, like anachronistic. Like, what year is this, right? It just apparently on their place, you know, and they only have room for like 30 kids at a time or something. Thank goodness. But like the
not anymore.
Oh, no.
Since the piece came out, because they were on, because the rules are, there's only so many kids per square acreage that the farm, that the facility sits on. They were on 86 acres. Now they're on 186 acres. They've acquired more land in the past like month or so. So legally, they're going to be able to bring in more kids.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Speaking of bringing in more kids, your description of how kids are transported to Shepherd's Hill was really chilling. Tell folks about the SHA escorts.
So it can be really stressful for a parent to send their kid away, and usually the kid doesn't know. And so instead of taking them to the place themselves, this facility and other facilities like it recommended using an escort service. And Trace uses Safe Passage Adolescent Services. And what happens is two beefy guys in a van pull up, usually like first thing in the morning or very late at night, come in, and they're the ones that tell the kid that they're being taken away to Shepherd's Hill Academy.
Because that's not traumatizing.
No, not traumatizing at all. And of course, the kid is going to freak the fuck out. And so they're prepared with restraints and they're prepared to get physical, and they shove the kid in the van and they take him to the farm.
Like, this is like, that's how
it's 2017 by the way.
In case people had forgotten, I've read the piece, and like, obviously, cause you and I are friends, like we talked about it beforehand. So like, I knew some of this stuff already. I promise, listeners, this is not like this is not new information happening for me right now, but it's still so shocking that this goes on and there hasn't been an uproar that has caused this and facility and others like it to shut down. Do people just not know that it's happening?
I think it's half people don't know, and then half people that do know don't realize what is actually happening.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes if we have gotten to a place, and I think about this with reproductive health a lot too, because there are a lot of parents have a lot of control. The Supreme Court has decided, you know, that parents have a right to parent how they choose, which in theory I'm super for. But there also have been cases that very specifically recognize the right, the autonomous rights of the kid to have, you know, some sort of control over their, you know, person. And those two things clash a lot at the Supreme Court. And I have to assume that's part of what's going on here, is that there really is a sense, especially with other people who are parents, of like not wanting to intrude on how someone else parents, right. I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
that's a nice way of looking at it.
I guess. I mean, like, I'm trying to figure out why nobody knows about this stuff, right? Like, that there, it has to be more than just, you know, it can't just be that people think that all the kids that end up there are troubled, right? Like, and right. So that it's fine. What happens?
They have,
there has to be more to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of money behind. There's a lot of lobbying groups that ensure that this that the information doesn't get out. I mean, for instance, Shepherd's Hill is a member of NATSAP, the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs. And they are one of the major roadblocks of stopping any bill coming to the floor to fix regulations in this area.
Why is it always money? I just, of course. Like, why,
of course it is.
Why didn't I assume that that was the case? You know,
last year the school, Shepherd's Hill, brought in $2.2 million. So that's good for the economy of Georgia, and that's more important than the children that are there. And it's not just children from Georgia; it's all over the country and the world. Trace brags about having students from 8 different countries.
We're not even exporting our bullshit anymore. We're just bringing people directly to
it.
Yeah. I really, like, I can't thank you enough for doing this work, particularly, you know, with your history. I mean, a lot of this hits, you know, close to home for you. And I just really, really appreciate, you know, your being willing to put the time and the energy into this, because everyone I know that's seen, you know, the piece has said to me, you know, that they had no idea and that they're glad that they know now.
Oh, that's really good to hear. It's important.
Yeah. It turns out what happens to our kids matters. And so all of them, problems or not, it turns out kids matter, science matters, and constitutional rights matter. So, like, maybe we can.
Yes.
hopefully if you're listening to the show, one of those things, if not all of them, will matter to you. So with that, we are out of time. Everyone has to go follow Aaron at Aaron Kappel, support their work. Aaron, I can't thank you enough for making time to come back on the show and for the work you do every day.
Thanks for having me.
This has been the Katie Speaks Show. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks again to Kit O'Connell and Aaron Kappel for stopping by. And thanks, of course, to Netroots Radio for the opportunity to show up here every week and say what I think, unedited and unrestrained. Should something you heard in the show made you consider a new perspective or want to learn more about an issue, links to articles and guests are included in the episode notes at katiespeak.com. While you're there, let me know about voices you want to hear from and issues you want to hear about. You can also find me on Twitter and Medium at Katie_speak or leave a comment on the show's Facebook page. The Katie Speaks Show is free and available to all. If you're able, consider supporting my broadcasting and other culture change work for as little as $1 a month through the Patreon website at patreon.com/Katie_speak or make a one-time donation at paypal.me/KatieSpeak_. Never forget that culture change is a long fight and we need you in it. So as always, take this advice from Audre Lorde. Caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation. And that is an act of political warfare. Rest up, we have work to do. A movie or go out to the zoo. Because I'm not dead yet, and neither are you. I know that work comes first. Believe me, I feel the same. But work ain't work without any play. And on that claim, I'll stick my name.
tell me so, 'cause I won't be offended. You're pretty cool, and my ultimate hope is that our friendship won't get suspended. Just let me know before I go if there's something fun that we can do. Because I'm not dead yet, and neither are you. That's right, I said, I'm not dead yet, and neither are you. One more time, for good measure. I'm not dead.